Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Happy Friday. I started off the first hour talking about John chapter 3, verse 30, that says, "He must increase, but I must decrease." That was kind of my prayer this morning. So I found it interesting that Dr. Alex McFarlane called me Paul 3 times in our last interview. So I guess in a way, my prayers were answered. So there we go. I found this kind of fascinating. This guy in Los Angeles wanted to get a ticket to the World Series. So he goes on this third-party ticket broker website and found a ticket that was under $10. So he called the site to make sure the company officials were saying that was, in fact, the price, $9.08. It was a mistake, they said, but we're going to go ahead and honor that offer anyway. Now, the cheapest seats for the series are about $1,000 a piece. So the guy ended up really probably paying more for parking than he did to get in and see the Dodgers lose game 2. But I'm sure that's a story he'll remember for a long, long time. And in Pennsylvania, a woman celebrated her 94th birthday by skydiving. Ela Campbell of Williamsport says she decided to take the 10,000-foot plunge because it was on her bucket list. Now, here's what I know about skydiving. When you jump out of a plane at 10,000 feet, it really smooths out your wrinkles, so hopefully she got a really good picture and she'll be able to update her MySpace page. Anyway, we got a great second hour coming up. Bob Trent's going to be with us. He is from the Alliance for Defending Freedom, ADF. He's the Director of Communications. We're going to talk about some of the Supreme Court cases, and then Chris Martin, our millennial evangelical, is going to be with us. So it's going to be a great hour as I look out the window and see what appears to be snow falling. Oh, yay, yay. All right, we'll be back in a minute, 6 minutes after the hour. Good morning and welcome back to the show. I have Bob Trent on the studio line this morning. He is from the Alliance for Defending Freedom, ADF. He leads the communication team at ADF, and prior to that, he was a reporter for ABC affiliate radio station KTAR in Phoenix and has held a variety of roles in broadcast, print, and internet media. But we're awfully glad that he's with us this morning. Bob Trent, good morning.
Thanks for having me. It's good to see you. Good to hear from you.
Thank you. We're very interested in what's going on with ADF. I know we've got several very volatile current campaigns you're working on. Jack Phillips is one that comes to mind. Very interested to find out what the update is on that.
Well, we are right in the middle of the briefing session, so we're submitting briefs to the court on arguments. And then also there have been a wide range of other organizations and creative professionals who've also submitted what we call front of the court briefs that say that, yes, that Jack should have the right to live and work and create art in accordance with his faith. And that is ultimately what the case is about. And, of course, the other side is submitting their briefs as well. But the lead attorney, Kristen Wagner, is deep in preparation for oral arguments before the Supreme Court on December 12th.
The outcome of that isn't going to be in June, is that right?
It could be any time after December 5th. The court typically saves some of the most important decisions for the end of June and as its term is wrapping up. And so we believe this is one of the most important cases affecting religious freedom in our lifetime. And so that would likely lead the court to release the decision sometime at the end of June.
Bob, I don't want to assume too much that our listeners know all the details of this case. I know this is such a big one, and maybe many do, but would you maybe go over some of the process that's involved with Jack Phillips and how this all came about, and just give our listeners a little backstory on it?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So in 2012, two men entered Jack Phillips' cake shop. That's Masterpiece Cake Shop. In Colorado, and it's called Masterpiece for a reason. You know, Jack opened it with two thoughts in mind in naming it Masterpiece. One, he wanted it to be a gallery of cakes. In fact, a reporter who came to review the work that he was doing in his cake shop called it a gallery of cakes. And so Masterpiece really was fitting with the idea that Jack was creating these edible works of art.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, you know, he also viewed the work as really a way to glorify the Lord, that in the idea that this is a masterpiece of creation, that he was honoring the Lord in everything that he was doing. In 2012, these two men come into Masterpiece Cake Shop and sit down and ask him to create a custom-designed wedding cake for their same-sex ceremony. And Jack said, "I'm sorry, but I cannot create a cake. I can't design a cake for a same-sex wedding, as that would be in direct conflict with beliefs." However, he offered to sell them anything else in the shop. In fact, he offered to design a custom cake for any other event virtually. There are some events, other events, that Jack won't design cakes for, other messages that he won't design. Things like Halloween cakes that are un-American, you know, that have expressed un-American or anti-American views, cakes that dishonor the Lord, or also cakes that disparage the LGBT community. He's declined as well. He really wants to design work that is consistent with his beliefs, so he just declined that job and offered to sell them virtually anything else in the store. And they stormed out. They were relatively rude in the process and immediately filed a complaint with the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. When they got involved, they determined that he was in violation of their sexual orientation, gender identity aspect of the public accommodations law in Colorado. And the result was that Jack was forced to, in order to comply with the commission's decision, gave up his wedding business. And what that meant to his small, you know, 10-employee cake shop was that they lost about 40% of their business. And Jack was forced to lay off 6 of his 10 employees. Just because Jack wanted to remain and had to remain, because of his beliefs, faithful. And that's what Jack has endured. It's not just the loss of business. Throughout the process, you know, one of the members on the Civil Rights Commission that ruled against him, in essence, compared him to a Nazi, which was particularly harmful to Jack, because his father fought in World War II and was one of the soldiers that liberated Buchenwald. I mean, it was deeply hurtful for him to be described in that way. His family works in the shop with him. They're the remaining employees. And, you know, Jack has endured death threats to the point where he had his family go into the back of the shop until the police could arrive. The court order against him not only, you know, kind of led him to decide that he can't take wedding cakes anymore, but he now has to re-educate his employees that operating his business and according with his faith is somehow wrong. And again, these employees are his daughter and his mom and his wife. So he's now being forced to re-educate his family that operating his business according to his faith is somehow wrong.
Mm.
He also, each time he declines a job, he has to report back to the government why he declined it. The idea that we have to report to the government specific choices that we're making in our personal lives, in our business lives, that's problematic. I mean, the idea that we'd be forced to report those decisions is somehow un-American to me.
Mm-hmm. I did not know that, Bob. That's really interesting about having to report to the government sales that you're turning away. I know I come from a generation where, and you might understand this as well, where if you went into a shop or any kind of establishment and you didn't really like what they said, you would kind of semi-storm out of there going, well, I'll take my business elsewhere. And you just went to the next place that would actually, you know, help you better or help you meet whatever it is you had. Sounds like the agenda is to literally destroy anybody that stands for any kind of religious values of any kind.
We do see this in other cases. You know, Jack's case went through the system and is now before the Supreme Court, a process that in this case has taken 5 years, which is not unusual. There are similar cases. Baronelle Stutzman, a florist out of Richland, Washington, she stands to lose everything she owns. The ACLU sued her personally, which would make her responsible for seven-figure attorney fees for the ACLU if, in fact, the Supreme Court doesn't rule in her favor. We've asked the Supreme Court to take up her case as well. And yes, it was a very similar situation. You know, Baronell served a man for 10 years, a man that she considered a friend, to the point where when he came in to ask again for her to create artistic expression, design custom work for his same-sex ceremony, she hugged him and said, "I'm sorry, Rob, I can't do this." And they parted friends, and she expected him to come back to ask her for additional work because of the way that, you know, they parted over that one simple design. She mm-hmm. designed work for him for 10 years. And yet the Attorney General of the state of Washington came after her. The ACLU came after her. And now, again, she does stand to lose everything simply because her deeply held beliefs about marriage, that it's between one man and one woman, is not in line with what the government version of marriage is.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, she stands to lose everything.
Oh, boy. Bob, let me take a break. When we come back, I'd like to talk about some of the other campaigns that are currently you're fighting for in just a minute. I'm speaking to Bob Trent from ADF. We'll take a short break and be back. Welcome back to the show. I've got on our studio line Bob Trent. He leads the communications team at ADF, which is the Alliance for Defending Freedom. And there are some campaigns going on right now that are in the fight. One of them is cake maker Jack Phillips. And there's also Defending Free Speech on Campus issue. Would you talk about that, Bob?
Well, sure. You know, Alliance Defending Freedom is a nonprofit legal ministry that advocates for the right of people to freely live out their faith in all of their walks of life. And quite often, kids on college campuses are finding themselves challenged with unconstitutional limits to their speech. You know, on a public campus, the only permit required to speak is the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. Constitution, and yet more and more often we find that colleges are putting into place policies that require advanced notice. You know, they need a permit from the administration if they're going to speak on a college campus, or they're limited to. We're just filing a case right now. 0.0013% of the college campus is allowed for free speech, one of these so-called free speech zones that, you know, so often we find on college campuses. And again, that is very nature unconstitutional. Or sometimes simply students are, you know, expressing a point of view, perhaps, that the
mm-hmm.
college doesn't agree with. So Alliance Defending Freedom was formed, you know, almost 25 years ago to take up these cases at no cost to those students, to people like Jack Phillips, to people like Baronell Stutzman. And yeah, we do find that colleges and college campuses are very challenging sometimes to student environments to express their First Amendment freedoms on campus. You know, the Center for Academic Freedom has won nearly 400 of these cases.
Wow.
That was formed. The problem is that there are 400 cases to win, but, you know, they win. In fact, ADF wins, you know, over 80% of the cases that we file, that we get involved with. And the Center for Academic Freedom really leads that charge. You know, Alliance Defending Freedom was founded, again, 25 years ago because people weren't showing up for these fights. These people, who were encountering these challenges didn't know where to turn. So Alliance Defending Freedom was formed to represent those people at no cost to them. We are entirely funded by donors across the country, you know, who can give maybe $75, $100, and that money adds up, and it goes directly to defend people who need the help.
Mm-hmm. Bob, I like the track record that Alliance Defending Freedom has. They have won nearly 80% of their cases, and they've played an important role in 53 victories in the Supreme Court. I want to stand up and cheer.
Thanks. you know, it's encouraging that the attorneys that we have on staff, you know, we have about 60 attorneys on staff, are so effective at what they do. The other aspect are the other parts of our ministry that we're involved with. You know, we train more than 2,000 attorneys to engage on these issues, and there are 3,200 total allied attorneys. And so these are attorneys who are allied with Alliance Defending Freedom. They're in communities all across the country. We get more than 3,000 requests each month for people who are experiencing issues like Jack Phillips experiences, like these kids on college campuses, or like pro-life pregnancy care centers in California who were told by the government of California that they had to advertise for the abortion industry.
Wow.
You know, in their own buildings. You know, when those people reach out to us, you know, we like to take all of them in-house. Sometimes we can't, and sometimes it's more appropriate to send to one of these local allied attorneys who, because we provided training to them, agree that they're going to donate back pro bono hours, in essence, represent people in their communities who are facing, you know, issues of religious liberty, of freedom of speech, pro-life issues, marriage and family, that, you know, challenged in their communities and in their ability to freely live out their faith in their lives, in their workplace, in the public square, on college campuses, and we represent them at no cost. But it all comes as the result of people who give sacrificially, you know, people who are willing to, donate, again, you know, $75, $100. In fact, mm-hmm. right now, if people can give a gift of $75, it'll help Alliance Defending Freedom defend not only the freedoms of the people that we've talked about on your show today, but also it protects everyone's freedom to live out their faith. When we win a case for someone like Jack, people are freer. When we win a case for someone like Baronel, for a student on the college campus, everybody's freedom is protected as the result. Alliance Defending Freedom was formed not just because no one else was showing up, you know, so we needed to get in the game, but we advocate to win, but not just for the current generation, but for the generations to come, our children, our grandchildren. We need to, in essence, draw a line in the sand and say, you know, we cannot continue to let our religious freedom be challenged in these ways. And Alliance Defending Freedom was formed specifically to draw that line and defend it.
You know, Bob, I'm not a rocket scientist, but this is something that I think every one of us would be eager and willing to get on board to help with, because this is about religious freedom. And I know that on tomorrow on Faith Radio at 8:30 in the morning, there's going to be a program on the Alliance for Defending Freedom that's going to talk about it and also give listeners a chance to donate to the cause. I think this is kind of a no-brainer, to be honest.
Well, we do as well, but honestly, we know that people, when they give to us, they do so sacrificially,
mm-hmm.
and we appreciate that so much. You know, written into our guiding principles is that we are not only committed to excellence, committed to victory, but we're also committed to stewardship. And we really believe that when we engage you, and we do so effectively. And the money that people give to us quite often results in things like, you know, those attorneys that we train to go and advocate for people in communities across the U.S., those allied attorneys, they've given back $206 million to people in their community that they're out defending, that they're helping to protect religious liberty in the communities across the country. And they're waiting to help right now.
Yeah.
Again, we have 3,000 requests that come in every single month.
Yep, we will definitely tune in. And Bob, before I let you go, very seldom do I meet a guy who went to a university whose name I simply cannot pronounce. Would you do it for me?
That's the University of St. Cyril and Methodi in the Republic of Macedonia in southeastern Europe.
Yeah, the spelling of it is like, I can't even begin to pronounce that. So thanks for that that pronunciation. And thanks for your work.
Sure, I'm happy to be on, and I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Have a great day, Bob. Bob Trent.
You too.
From ADF, we'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Hello and good morning. It's 31 minutes after the hour. We're going to take a little news break because it's important to get good news. And I hope I hope there is good news coming, because we're going to, after that, speak to Chris Martin, our millennial evangelical friend, and we're going to get an interesting perspective from Chris on the way millennials think about money and how they talk about it, among other things. We'll be back in just a minute. It's 25 minutes until the top of the hour. We've got Chris Martin already on our studio line, so we're going to talk to him in just a minute. But before that, David Capes, he's a professor, a radio host, and author. He said many people enter into conversations with people that differ from them with fear and trepidation. David encourages us to listen first, especially when having faith conversations.
As I listen, truly listen to what Jews believe, what Muslims believe, what Catholics and other Christians believe, I'm not Catholic, but I've got great respect for my Catholic friends. As I listen to these folks, I can learn something about the world. I can learn something about them. I can learn something about how God has been dealing and acting in the world. And that gives me hope. And it has also given me the sense that, okay, if all I know is my faith and what I believe, then I don't know much. I've got to contrast what I believe with what somebody else believes in order to get some clarity about that. What is different between Christianity and Islam? What is different between Christianity, say Protestant Christianity, and Catholic Christianity? It's when we engage those questions, if we really listen to the other person, it's not a matter of giving up on our own faith, but what we find is our faith growing and our faith progressing and deepening in beautiful ways that we had not yet expected.
Okay, that is the recurring theme, is to be listening. I think I've heard that more than any other thing since I've taken this job at Faith Radio, and now I'm all conflicted because I talk. Should I listen? Should I talk? I'm so confused. Anyway, it's David Capes is the author. If you want to hear that full interview, head over to myfaithradio.com. We've got this very cool search engine. Type in David Capes, just like the Superman's cape. Easy to remember. We'll take a short break, and then Chris Martin's with us from some obscure hotel room. Be back in a minute.
Change is tough, and usually change creates all kinds of conflict. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. God has called you as a parent to work toward better things for your family, even if that means instigating stuff that makes your kids uncomfortable. You're standing for good, honorable, and necessary things that will make your home a better place to live in today and years in the future. In fact, your decisions may even impact the family for generations. So, let the conflict come. I'd even encourage you to embrace conflict. Bring it on. It's a sign that real change is happening. You have the power to point your family in the right direction. So be encouraged, Mom and Dad. God's working through you, even in conflict.
Mark Gregston is the author of a brand new book for grandparents titled Leaving a Legacy of Hope. Learn more. Go to ParentingTodaysTeens.org.
It is 22 minutes until the top of the hour. I saw on Conan last night, Aaron Rodgers had 13 screws put in to repair his collarbone. Those screws better have been made in Wisconsin. I don't know where they make screws, but anyway. Speaking of obscurity, Chris Martin, our millennial evangelical friend, is with us. And I said you were in some obscure hotel room, which means you're busy traveling on the road. Where are you, Chris?
I'm in Dallas, Texas.
Nice.
This weekend.
What
yeah,
do you got,
I've never
do you got
been
going?
To Dallas before.
Oh, Dallas is great.
Yeah. It is nice. I'm just here for a conference to help me do a few parts of my job that I do on a daily basis a little bit better. So I'm just here to learn from some people, a couple friends and I.
Nice.
Our friend and I are here from Nashville. So yeah, it'll be fun.
Nice.
It'll be
now,
fun.
Now, millennials, interestingly enough, are, and to my surprise, are much more willing to talk about how much money they make. Now, I've always said that I just want to make enough money that my salary is public information. After that, I don't really talk about it.
A lot of people whose salaries are public information don't make much money because they're government employees.
That's true.
But it's funny, you know, when I was looking at this article in the New York Post, it was funny because I read the headline and I was like, yep, that's exactly right. and only from experience. Like I they have some data to kind of back up their point, but my millennial friends and I, we talk about our salaries more than I ever remember my parents or their friends talking about their salaries.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it may seem surprising. It's surprising. It may be surprising to a lot of people that people talk about their salaries at all. But as I understand the millennial generation, it's not particularly surprising to me. And there are a few reasons why. I don't know why, as a millennial and as someone growing up, I never understood why people didn't talk about how much money they made. Now that I'm an adult, I understand why people don't talk about how much money they make, because mm-hmm. they either don't want to feel bad themselves, perhaps, or they don't want to make someone else feel like they're less worthy or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of times people just don't talk about how much money they make because they either find their value in how much money they make and they don't want to feel lesser than perhaps someone that they would be comparing with, or they don't want to make someone else feel lesser because that person makes less money than they do. There are other reasons to be sure, but a lot of it I feel like is either a protection of the self or a common courtesy perhaps to protect others. With millennials, I think a lot of us, because we're young and new to the workplace, we're kind of comfortable with the fact that a lot of us aren't making a whole lot of money. Now, some of us are getting older now and we're getting perhaps into our second or third promotions or jobs where we are making a little bit more money and we may become more closed about that.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times too, I think millennials just care about money. They have, data has shown, they care about money less than other generations have. They care because there are a ton of studies that I don't have right in front of me, so I can't cite the data exactly. But there are a number of studies that show that a millennial will take a job at a company that has a clear value structure and morality structure similar to theirs with less money than taking a job at a company that would allow them to make more money but has no sort of social implication or some sort of way that they can make a difference in the world,
mm-hmm.
if you know what I mean. So I think data in general shows us that money is not as much of an core identity factor to millennials as perhaps it was for other generations. So they may feel more comfortable sharing it, and they may feel more comfortable making less money than their peers, assuming they're doing different work. Perhaps they wouldn't be comfortable if they were doing the same work and getting paid less.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not going to feel as self-conscious about it as maybe older generations did.
Chris, here are a couple of questions for you. Does social media and the platforms on which people live, where there's a lot of comparison and a lot of getting into other people's business way more than we ever used to, does that make it easier for people to share how much money they make?
Yeah, I think millennials, like every generation, are finding their identities in the wrong places. I just think they're finding their identities in social affirmation and social standing, which could certainly be enhanced by money, right? You can look like a cooler person and look like you live a more lavish lifestyle put forward a more complete social sort of persona if you make a lot of money. You know, you can look like you are really – you have it all together. But I think a lot of millennials are, quite frankly, more concerned with how much they're liked by their peers and how that affirmation comes through social media and other such avenues than they are about whether or not they make more money than their peers do.
Mm-hmm. Chris, how have millennials largely made their money when they were younger growing up? I mean, the statistics say about 8% of baby boomers share information with their colleagues about how much money they make. I'm just curious about how millennials made money when they were younger. Did the parents just sort of say, here's an allowance, or did they say, you really have to do X to earn your allowance?
Sure. I think it probably varies from home to home, certainly culture to culture, mm-hmm. and things like that. I think, you know, just to give you an example from my life, I was given a small allowance when I was a kid for doing little chores around the house. I think when I was in middle school, my allowance was bumped up a little bit. And maybe even when I was in high school, before I had a job, I was getting an allowance because my parents actually encouraged me to try playing football and other sports rather than getting a job,
mm-hmm.
Because they didn't need me to contribute to, you know, to paying for things in our home. We were in such a situation. A lot of, unfortunately, I mean, a lot of homes are in a situation where a child is encouraged, or, you know, once they become an adolescent, once they get to high school, they're encouraged to get a job to contribute to the home and mm-hmm. to help make house payments or help buy groceries. I was never in that scenario. So my parents didn't tell me to get a job as soon as I got to high school. So I was playing sports, but then, and they were giving me an allowance then to kind of, you know, let me go out with my friends and things like that. But then when I became a junior in high school and I stopped playing football, I got a job at a local pizzeria and waited tables for 2 years until I went to college. So I think a lot of millennials perhaps are getting allowances and their parents are giving them money if they're in a financial situation, which they can. But then a lot of millennials also, you know, got jobs, and I think it was kind of similar to a lot of other generations, but perhaps older generations like boomers and et cetera were maybe more encouraged to get jobs earlier. But for me and a lot of my friends, and just kind of anecdotally from my life experience, a lot of my friends got jobs once they got to high school when they wanted – either their parents weren't giving them an allowance and they wanted to make money, or they wanted more money than their parents were giving them an allowance.
Yeah.
So I think – but now here's the thing. What's really funny is about – I know I'm not here to talk about iGen, which is the kind of commonly – use name for the generation following millennials, so like the generation that's in high school right now. Mm-hmm. I've just finished a book on them called iGen, and they are not in a hurry to get their driver's licenses, which is super interesting to me. For your generation, I'm sure, for mine, getting a license was vital to social success.
8 o'clock morning of my birthday.
If you wanted to, yeah, I think the law in Indiana at the time when I got mine was you got it a month and a day after your 16th birthday.
Okay.
So I got it like 2 days after Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
It's vital to social success. You know, today teens are hanging out on their smartphones so much and not hanging out in person that they're delaying getting their driver's licenses because they don't need to hang out with each other in person, and their parents will willingly drive them around.
Right.
Places. Okay. So anyway, it's super interesting, but
yeah. Chris, let me take a break. We are definitely in different generations. I remember I had my first asbestos removal business by age 8.
Nice.
Thanks. We'll take a break. Be more back with Chris Martin in just a minute. Good morning. It's 10 minutes until the top of the hour. Chris Martin's with me on our studio line. Chris, I found this article fascinating about the five industries millennials are killing. What are they and why?
So there are a number of industries millennials are killing. Before we get into the article, I have to say that you guys would appreciate this. Maybe when I finally get it, I'll take a picture and send it to you on Twitter or something. There's this shirt out there. That is a collage of headlines like this one and others that it cites. That is all these different headlines from articles online about things millennials are killing. So millennials are killing Wheaties. Millennials are killing Applebee's. Millennials are killing, and it's just a shirt with this. It's awesome. I'm gonna show it to you. But millennials are killing a lot of things, and my belief is they're killing them because they don't have money.
Okay.
So here are five things millennials are killing. One, casual chain restaurants. So restaurants like Applebee's have tried and failed to reach millennials. Restaurants like Buffalo Wild Wings, Ruby Tuesday, and others are having declining sales because millennials are preferring more small business kind of restaurants, family-owned restaurants, restaurants that can give them perhaps healthier food than the restaurants that also have frozen bagged appetizers at your local grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing millennials are killing, diamonds. In 2016, The Economist tweeted a really funny tweet that they didn't intend to be funny with an article, and the tweet said, "Why aren't millennials buying diamonds?" And replies included, "You mean besides the crippling debt and because you can't live in a diamond or eat a diamond?" And so really, those people are really funny, and it's true. People, millennials aren't going to splurge on – and also, I mean, they're not getting married as early. They're not developing deep, long-term relationships as early. Those are the kinds of people you typically buy diamonds for. Not people that you meet on Tinder and hang out with once or twice.
You're killing me, Chris.
It kind of makes sense. I think it kind of makes sense. And the Economist has no idea what they were tweeting over a year and a half ago.
Oh, that's funny.
Three, home ownership. This one's – we've talked about this before, I think. This one's pretty simple. Millennials are killing home ownership because they're not – they don't have the money to buy houses. I mean,
Let's back up with this one. Are millennials getting help from their parents with down payments?
Some maybe. I've heard stories of that where we almost did that when we bought our house in April of 2016, and we almost used my parents' help to get a down payment and like gave them money back over time. We ended up having not to. I think it is within the realm of possibility that millennials are getting help from parents for down payments, which I actually, you know, some perhaps more curmudgeonly perspectives would say that that's bad. I actually think it's kind of smart for if millennials have parents that can give them money to help them get a down payment. Because the thing here's just – I'll give you a little peek into like my personal struggle with this when we were looking to buy a house. The house payment we make now is like $10 or $12 more than what we were paying monthly in rent for an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
So I was infuriated when we had an apartment because I was like, I'm throwing money away every month to rent when the only reason is because I can't make a down payment. Because I can make a house payment and I can make an apartment payment, but I can't make a down payment. And that's the only reason I'm throwing money away at rent. And so I think that's the case for a lot of millennials, especially those kind of like me who are living near or around, you know, in big cities, is we're paying as much for rent as we would be for a mortgage payment, but we can't because of our crippling educational debt and other such debts, mostly educational, we can't make a $20,000 or $30,000 down payment or even less than that. To keep from all kinds of other costs. So I think maybe millennials are relying on their parents a little bit, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah. Now, Chris, as a homeowner, don't you feel like now you're just moving your assets from one location to another? Because when you're paying a rent check, it's gone for good, and now you're just transferring assets from one place to another.
Yeah. Right. If I stop to think about it too much, I shudder at how much at what percentage of my monthly payment is interest. But
you mean tax deductible interest?
But to get even more personal with you, we owned a home 9 months of last year,
mm-hmm.
and it still wasn't enough to give me an itemized deduction.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, it is smart, I think, for millennials to do whatever they can to try to own a home. Because it's smart to start investing in a home, especially I think in the market that we're in most places.
Mm-hmm.
But moving on, the fourth thing millennials are killing, movie theaters and cable TV. This also makes complete sense. Netflix, man. Netflix and YouTube are killing everything.
Yeah.
And for me, like, I love going to see movies. But to pay, you know, $10 to watch a movie once, and then if I want any snacks to basically buy an expensive dinner for popcorn, it's kind of just doesn't make – like I'd rather just wait, you know. And then five, cereal, which I don't understand because
I
love
either.
Cereal.
Yeah.
Everyone blames like toast. like artisan toast is a big thing in urban centers right now. The joke is avocado toast, which I'm not a big avocado guy, but millennials are super into more niche breakfast foods nowadays, I guess.
Okay.
And are kind of ditching cereal, which is unfortunate, I think.
Well, Chris, I must say that this you supported the theory that millennials are comfortable talking about money. Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Have a great day. I'll talk to you again in a couple weeks.
Yeah, you too.
Yep, that's Chris Martin, the Millennial Evangelical. Go to millennialevangelical.com and you can see more of his writing. We'll take a short break and wrap up the show. That wraps up the show. Thanks for listening. I want to say a big happy birthday to my friend Jack, who's just recently back in town from overseas travel. Glad to have you back safe in the country. Have a great birthday. Everyone else, have a great weekend. I'll see you Monday. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.